This is an episode of Choose Your Issues. That's the podcast, or Occasional Now podcast, from the Objectivism Program at the Salem Center at the University of Texas. I'm Greg Salmieri. I'm a senior scholar of philosophy in the center and teach in the philosophy department. Joining me today first is Gina Gorlin, who is a member of our program and who teaches in the psychology department here at the university. This podcast grew out of a conversation she and I were having last week. It's sort of an impromptu podcast. We haven't advertised it. And we were talking about, do we have anything to say about an issue that's on everybody's minds now, particularly on our minds, the attacks by Hamas, incursions, invasion, however you want to think about it. And one of the questions is how to think about it, by Hamas into Israel. The general situation between Israel and the Palestinians, as they are called, and the how we sort of understand this issue. And so I want to just say to Gina, let's talk for a moment or two about kind of our thinking about this, why we want to do a podcast on this, and then we have a guest who we'll bring in a moment.
Thanks, Greg. Yeah, I mean, for my part, as you know from our conversation, I've felt very torn about what to say, how much to say. You know, on my Substack, Building the Builders, and in my various public commentary on the psychology of entrepreneurship, of ambition, some of my readers may have noticed I stay away from politics pretty summarily and deliberately because, well, for many different reasons, it's not my area of expertise. It, I think, has a way of, you know, provoking the kind of reflex, gut emotion-driven reactions that can stop thinking short. And here I am trying to really promote thinking from first principles. And at the same time, if ever there was a circumstance that feels relevant for me to comment on from a builder's kind of standpoint, and just from a personal standpoint, this feels like it. When Ukraine was attacked by Russia, that was my probably one other departure from the non-political restriction I put on myself, because as you know, I'm from Ukraine. I felt so personally connected to what was happening there. And it was so salient to me that, wow, Ukraine has really become a country of builders, like, in a way I hadn't appreciated. And it was suddenly through this really devastating crisis, it became front and center and really a shining example in a lot of people's eyes around the world that, wow, like, you know, Ukraine is now, it's a country where technology and freedom and the kind of modern ambitiousness and scrappiness and entrepreneurial thinking are really flourishing. And I wanted to defend that, to really support and promote that. And now, in some ways, I feel even more personally connected to Israel for lots of reasons. I've been there. I have friends there. I have family there. But also, from a builder's standpoint, I use a bunch of their products. My life is better because of Wix.com and because of Teva Pharmaceuticals, which makes the medication without which I wouldn't function. And it feels like a beacon of civilization in certain ways, of just the sort that I am trying to bolster, that I'm trying to support. And it's under attack. And so, so I wanted to, go ahead, Greg.
A bit about this idea of builders and building. So that's been a theme in your work recently, and you know, in somewhat different terms, the theme in Ayn Rand's writing, the theme in my writing. But what is the central idea is that there's something good, ennobling, inspired, important about creative work, about productive work, about creating things, building things. I think the builder's theme is coming from Marc Andreessen in that particular language, but the idea that we need to make things. And I mean, Ukraine is a country that's maybe earlier in its trajectory as being liberated and being a productive power. But Israel is a place where it really stands out. It's a technology hub. It's, but I mean, one thing we want to think about is how does all of this relate to moral assessment? You might think that doesn't tell you who's in the right or wrong about a conflict. How do we think about that? How do we think about the justice of this? One of the things that came out in your and my conversation the other day is just this is an issue we both have opinions on, or opinions in the same direction. We're very much on the Israeli side of this issue and really horrified by the actions of Hamas, horrified and not that surprised by them. That is, you could see this coming. This is not out of character for this organization or for the movement that it's embodies. And yet this isn't a subject that we're experts on foreign policy, on this part of the world, on these particular groups, on Israel and its history. And it's, you know, one doesn't want, there's so much that's been written about this, that's been said, that's been argued, it's such a contentious issue in so many people's minds, that one of the things I want to think about is sort of, what can we know about this without being experts? And we've asked a friend to join us who is an expert on this issue, who's written a book, What Justice Demands on the Israel-Palestine conflict. I'll bring him on in just a minute, Alon Giorno. And one of the things that I really value about his book is that it addresses itself to people who aren't already partisans on this issue, who don't have a strong opinion about it, doesn't take it for granted that you're going to agree with him or be a member of his tribe, and yet also doesn't try to be mealy-mouthed about it. He's got a strong stand. He's, you know, wants to urge you to take that strong stand and is trying to give you the information you need to be able to tell whether that's the right stand to take. So he's, I think, just one of the really clear voices on this issue, someone who I thought could add a lot of clarity. And so we're bringing him on. And Alon, welcome to our program.
Well, thank you for having me, Greg and Gina. It's a pleasure to be here. And I was really excited when you reached out to me because of the angle that you often talk about, this theme of builders, because I think that's a really good way into the topic and to connect it to the moral question which you raised as well. And I just want to say one thing to build on your description of my book. It definitely is not a book that has a choir to which it's preaching. It is a book that has offended Zionists, and it's a book that's offended pro-Palestinian people because it belongs to no tribe. And one of the things I try to convey in the book is that it takes real thinking to understand and disentangle this complicated issue. And what I try to do in the book is take a moral framework that I think is one that many people, if they value life, they value progress, if they value freedom, they can sign on to, and they can use that to understand the essentials of the conflict. So my hope is that people who engage with it will be able to approach it from that perspective. There's a lot to say about how it's differentiated, but that's one of the things I think about. It's a secular approach, not a religious approach. It's not tribal. It's about the value of individual lives. And it's about, and this is where I think there's a real strong nexus between your interests and mine. One way I think about the criteria that we should apply to different countries and how we evaluate the region and Israel in particular and how we think about policy in that area is how well do particular countries enable individuals to flourish, to build, to grow, to develop, to innovate, and to become the kind of people that I know Gina's work is really focused on. And that to me is a clear standard that if you care about progress in life and freedom, that's a way into this. And it helps disentangle a lot of the confusions that people have. And I think it's an objective way of evaluating things. So to me, this is, and one other sort of personal dimension to this, which is I've been doing different interviews and writing about this topic since last week when the Hamas invasion began. And to me, it's refreshing to be able to spend some time thinking and talking about the virtues for which I think Israel deserves to be understood. And those are not, in my view, the virtues of Israel are not rooted in its religious or tribal character. Those are definitely part of its character, but I don't think they're its fundamental virtues. It's the reasons to side with Israel have to do with its political character and its ability, and the fact that people who are builders are able to do the work that they want to do and to flourish.
Go ahead, Gina.
Just to build on what you were saying, Alon, it seems crucial to both of our frameworks, or I think the framework that underlies both of our work, that builders of any ethnic background, builders of any religion, builders from any tribe, because that's not the unit of analysis here, right? Individual builders, whatever their group membership, identity, origin, equally can thrive and can build themselves a life worth living. Like, that seems really, really key. And in terms of what's that metric on which we're going to gauge a given country and its political system.
Well, but even if it's not equally, right? Because I could hear people alleging, but it's not equal in Israel. Israel's an apartheid state. Israel's a ethno state. Israel's a and whether or not those things are true, we'll come back to whether they're true. But I think the thing that's striking here, you could imagine a state in which people aren't all equally free to build, in which people aren't all equally free to live their lives, in which some people are advantaged unjustly over others. Mm-hmm. And when that's the case, when you have real grievances against people, and I mean, I think all of us have grievances against most states, that there are some things they do wrong with.
Including our own.
Yeah.
But that's not our focus today.
What kind of a response to injustice, even to evil, is a virtuous response? And what does the kind of response that we see people making say about them and say about the nature of the conflict? And I think what the nature of the attacks that we saw from Hamas, the parachuting into a concert and shooting up a bunch of young people, the breaking into the nurseries and kibbutzes and decapitating babies, it's these kinds of things that I think have really horrified the world. Not even just terrorism, but where you're terrorizing a civilian population with a particular focus on babies. And this seems like pure naked evil. And there are some people who are still, you know, posting, you know, I stand with Palestine or whatever, maybe thinking this isn't representative of them, or maybe this is actually what they want. And for some of them, I think it is what they want. But I think so much of the world has recoiled in horror from this, recognizing there's something really evil about these kinds of attacks. And that's created a moment of thinking like, well, what is this? How do we understand this context? And I think ultimately you have to connect it back to what's good or bad about Israel and what's good or bad about the people who are opposing Israel. And not everyone in Israel is the same. Not everyone who's opposing them is the same exactly. But I think there's something specific and brutal and horrific about these attacks. And I think we should spend some time thinking about, like, what is it? And could this be a response to injustice? Like, is this what it looks like for oppressed people or their champions to be responding to it? And maybe there's something to this that side of the story. Or is there something about the nature of this kind of attack that's just not compatible with that reading? And with this movement that's just not compatible with the reading of this is the movement of an oppressed people seeking freedom or seeking a better life for themselves?
Yeah, I think part of what has made it hard for me to know what to say about this conflict is that my typical unit of analysis is individuals, right? And I think part of what we're all kind of gesturing at is that there's a way of understanding this whole conflict, kind of starting from individuals as the unit of analysis, or starting from something else, starting from the tribe, starting from the collective, something like that. And part of what I want, what I would love both of your help with, is thinking about how do you, if you start from the unit of analysis of what, you know, individuals and the moral assessment and what is, you know, psychologically healthy and constructive at an individual level for coping with evil, for addressing grievances, and then help me think about how that then manifests at a cultural level, because it clearly does, right? There are culture-wide trends, ideas, movements, currents that represent the accumulated thinking of some powerful individuals and that then get picked up, right, by a kind of zeitgeist of individuals who are swept up in those motivations, in that ideology. And I'd love to be able to think about, you know, how is that happening here?
Well, if I can respond to your comment, Greg, because I think you're raising the question on many people's minds right now is, how could this be, what to make of this, really? That's the way I would summarize it. And I think it would be useful to spend a few minutes talking about the two sides in this conflict and thinking about what is a way to evaluate them. And then I think that's a frame for thinking about what is a just or appropriate response to actual injustice, because I think that's the crux of your question, the concern that some people have. I think the first thing to know is that both the Palestinian cause is a movement. It's an ideological political movement. Those things are hard for people to think about. It's just not obvious how to think about movements. That's just, you can see that in different contexts, but it's particularly so with the Palestinian movement. And on the other side, what we have is Israel, which is the fulfillment of another ideological political movement, which is the Zionist movement, which again is a complex thing to disentangle. So let me offer my thoughts on this, and I'm interested in your reactions. And this is by way of saying, there's more to say about each of these, but and that's why there's a need for a book, and even the book doesn't get into the full scope of it. But let me just gesture towards what the perspective is that I bring to it. The Zionist movement was a mixed bag to begin with, but it was reacting to a real problem arising in Europe, which is at the turn of the century, the turn of the 20th century, late 1900s, the beginning of the 1900s, what you see is that people who are of Jewish background, and I say it in those terms because it's not the case that you had to be a practicing Jew. A lot of Jews were assimilated in Europe, which means that they were secular. They were classical liberals. They were socialists. And I see you're raising your hand. The only way in which you might identify them as Jews in terms of their heritage or background is by their name or by their physiognomy or both. And even then, it's not the case that all Jews are recognizably Jewish. And what you found, what was the insurmountable problem is that however assimilated someone might have been at the time in Europe, they were still subject to prejudice, persecution, bigotry, and it just mounted and grew worse and worse. And different countries were better and worse, but it was really, really an unavoidable problem. And of course, the more recognizably Jewish you were, so if you wore some of the Jewish religious garments and so on, more recognizable, more subject to that. And this is where the Zionist movement starts to take shape. And I'll just flag that the Zionists themselves, when they met numerous times to figure out what are we about, what are we trying to solve here, they had an understanding of the problem. They didn't have a clear view of the answer. And what you get is a conglomeration of better elements. So the influence of people like Theodor Herzl, who was the sort of the spearhead of this movement in many ways, who was a classical liberal, anti-theocracy, very much oriented towards building and production. The flag that he envisioned for a Jewish state was seven stars to symbolize the 7 hours of the workday. So it's very much in that angle. And then you also get various kinds of religious groups who are part of the Zionist movement, each of them pulling into different degrees towards, well, Israel, if we have a country in this historic territory, it needs to be more Jewish, it needs to be more religious, and they were recoiling. So there's a real infighting around what this realization of this solution might look like. And the outcome, and I'm skipping over some of the history, the outcome is a country that reflects a lot of those tensions and contradictions. Its essential character since 1948 is a progressive, basically socialist-oriented economy that becomes more and more free towards the recent decades. And with a separation of religion and state that is imperfect at best. It's nothing like the American separation. But there's enough of a classical liberal individualist respect for freedom in the country, and it gets better over time. So the major court cases that liberate free speech, that liberate the economy, that sort of privatize the economy away from the sort of socialist elements. And in the end, you get a society that in its political character resembles United Kingdom, Denmark, France, in terms of a welfare state, but also major elements of freedom in the society. And that's, so then you get sort of the Zionist movement becomes something in the background, because now there's the realization of part of its aim in a society, in a country that has territorial integrity. That's, and we can talk a bit more about the details of that, but that's sort of one side of this story. The other side is the Palestinian movement or cause, which as you can imagine, the scholarship on this is highly contested, but the history, as I find it plausible, is that it's a reaction to the beginnings of what is the thought of Israel. So when people start immigrating to the area known as Palestine at the time under the British rule, there is both a welcome reaction, that people get jobs who live there, they're able to sell their land to the newcomers, but there's also recoil. These are the more traditional elements of society, the more religious element of the society. They don't like the foreigners coming in, especially not the Jews, because there's just long-standing animosity towards Jewish people in the Middle East for a number of reasons. And what arises is a movement that isn't what we know today as the Palestinian movement. It's slightly influenced towards nationalism. It's led by people who want to be dictators. So the kind of leaders that you would see decades later in Jordan and Iraq. The real birth of the Palestinian movement as we recognize it today is really in the 60s and 70s. And this is a outgrowth of Arab regimes surrounding Israel that did not want Israel to come into being. They fought a couple of wars to try to abort the founding of Israel. And when they realized they couldn't do it, they put their bets on what was an incipient guerrilla movement of Palestinians who said, these regimes weren't able to do the job of wiping Israel off and removing the Jews from our land. So this is from a tribal perspective. And what we're going to do is we're going to fight them. And in the background, you get the funding of countries like Syria and Egypt, essentially training these militias and arming them and giving them safe harbor. And what emerges is a shift into the Palestinian movement is seen as a scrappy freedom fighting movement. That's the rhetoric they gave. And it's also a national liberation movement. And so it integrates with the sort of the intellectual currents of the 70s and onward. If you think about the kind of perspective that people brought to Latin American freedom fighters and the way they were seen. But essentially the Palestinian movement, so we think about movements as a complex thing of numerous factions, just as the Zionists had numerous factions. But one thing that's differentiated about the Palestinian movement is uniformly, whether they were secular, Marxist, or Marxist-Leninist, or just watered-down socialist, or Arab nationalists, what was uniform about them was the absence of classical liberal free market or any kind of individual rights-respecting ideas. Just sort of uniformly, they were tilted towards collectivized dictatorial goals. In terms of if you gave them, here's the territory, what would you build? What kind of society would you build? It's just variations on the kinds of regimes you see in the Middle East, which are authoritarian, dictatorial, theocratic. And that's sort of the cluster of the Palestinian movement, which takes shape under the Palestinian Liberation Organization, which is sort of like a government in waiting for the future Palestinian state. Okay, so that's sort of the big picture, the two different movements in effect and how each of them has variations, but there is a certain identity to each one, sort of a thematic identity to each one. And what happens in the big turning point that I want to just leave you with, and we can talk more about the other elements of this. The big turning point is when the Palestinian movement goes from being this cluster of socialist, nationalist, and authoritarian groups to an Islamist movement. Now, the Islamists came to dominate. Now, Hamas is the chief faction within this. The others are still around, but they're so marginal, they're not really central to what the Palestinian cause is about anymore. And this turning point comes in the late 70s. 1979 is a turning point in the Middle East when Iran becomes an Islamic regime and sort of inspires countless other factions to go in that direction. You see the Palestinians as a movement going from, well, nationalism didn't work for us, but the way of Allah does work for us. And there's key figures where that's sort of a transformation for them. Hamas and Islamic Jihad become rivals in terms of who was going to lead this movement. And the Iranians become state backers of the Palestinian cause, more so than regimes like Egypt or Syria, who are sort of fall into the background. So what you have then is this trajectory of a movement that is widely seen as an underdog, and I put that in scare quotes because I think we have to unpack what an underdog is, but then it becomes essentially a variation on the theme of ISIS or Taliban or Saudi Arabia, which is a religiously motivated movement where the goal is some sort of religious authoritarian or dictatorial regime. And so that's sort of the arc of things, and we can unpack each of those things. But this goes to the question that Greg is asking. There are grievances that you can point to among Palestinian individuals. And the Palestinian movement, as its MO, has hijacked those or has co-opted them to give it a sense of credibility, both to win over followers who see it as the vanguard for that cause, but also because this is part of what the outside world would see as you're trying to right wrongs for these people. So then the question is, what are those grievances and how do you right them? Well, I think there's a lot of work to do to think about what the grievances are, how to evaluate them. But what I argue, and again, this is the longest chapter in the book, and unpacking the Palestinian grievances is a difficult topic. But what I argue is that while there are actual injustices that individual Palestinians can point to, and there's questions about how you resolve those injustices, there is not a grievance that justifies creating an authoritarian or dictatorial regime. There's no Palestinian grievance, however justified, that warrants creating an ISIS-like regime or an Iran-like regime that is a religious theocracy. And that uses, and so it's if that's your goal, if your goal is to exploit people and tyrannize them, it isn't surprising that terrorism has been long a chosen means to advance your ends. So it's never been an accident that terrorism is associated with the Palestinian cause. It was a deliberate choice from the beginning, both under the sort of nationalist, ethnic and socialist factions, but even more so under the Islamists, because to them, their goal is not about creating a society for people to live and thrive. The goal is to create a society that exploits and dominates and subdues and tells people not go and build, but go and obey and bow. And so to me, that goes to... Yeah, and destroy, because it's unavoidable that if that's the kind of society you're building... I mean, I just read an article before we came on today about there was a very small startup company, sort of a little incubator in Gaza, and it's destroyed because of what Hamas is doing to that territory. So it's not that Hamas is trying to create a good society and failing or falling short. It is not trying to do that. Its goal is exactly the opposite. It's about destroying people's lives and dominating them. So when you have, go ahead.
Sorry. So I'm imagining, you know, some of my readers who might, you know, listen or read what we're saying here. And hearing you describe these movements and their overarching goals and motivations and actions as political players on this global stage, I'm trying to imagine, like, from the perspective of an individual person, an individual farmer, an individual like student or person trying to build a startup, a Palestinian person living in, say, you know, in Gaza or in one of these quote occupied territories, like, what good does any of this do me as someone who I can't cross over, you know, these barriers to get home to my family or to trade my wares? I can't, you know, like, I would really be feeling a lot of this restriction on my life and livelihood. And like, what do we have to say to those individual people who didn't choose, although arguably, you know, whether or not they voted for Hamas, but I mean, we're also talking about children, we're talking about, you know, people who may or may not even have voting rights, but like they're living with the situation, you know, what would we say to them?
I think the two things that come to mind. One is to just rewind the history a little and look at what there are two territories that are considered the Palestinian territories that would be a state in the future if all the sort of political plans fall in place. One is the West Bank, which is a rump in the middle of the country that borders Jordan. And the other is the Gaza Strip, which people have probably seen on lots of maps in the last few days, which borders the Mediterranean and Egypt. And when those territories were under Israel's military occupation, this is a 25, 26 year period when that was the case. This is a change in from when it was under Jordanian or Egyptian rule. So Israel occupied these territories and it oversaw them. I don't think occupation is anyone's vision of a good society, of what an ideal society was, but it was so much better comparatively to what was the case under Egypt or Jordanian rule, that those societies were flourishing compared to other nations. So, I mean, one of the measures that people look at is gross national product. And in the 1970s, and this is under military occupation, so it's not an ideal society, those territories were growing faster than Israel, and they were growing at a rate better than most of the neighboring Arab countries. And that's partly because the people living there had some amount of freedom to go into Israel and trade and work and build and trade and sort of gain employment. And so that was a constant commuter business, basically. That's an important piece of context for thinking about what's going on in those same territories since 1993 and 2005. So 1993 is a watershed because there was a U.S.-sponsored peace agreement that gave both of these areas to what was going to be a proto-state, the Palestinian Authority. And then in 2005, the Gaza Strip falls under the Hamas control during an election, and then there's a civil war. So what happens to both of these areas since 93 and 2005? Their economies crater, because what happens is that the Palestinian cause becomes a government, and it's just like most of the Arab governments nearby, which is it's authoritarian. It doesn't allow freedom in the way that Israel did. So less freedom than what they had under occupation.
So for example, like I'm a person living in the Gaza Strip before and after, like what would be different for me?
Yeah. So it's let me give you an actual person, not a hypothetical person. So there's a businessman from Qatar who came to found a bank because he felt really connected to the Palestinian territories. So he came in and he invested and he decided to build this bank, knowing that finance is a huge engine of progress. And what happened to him is that he fell afoul of what is in effect the dictator of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, Yasser Arafat. This is in the 90s. And they basically the PLO factions, they had multiple police forces. They show up and they say, well, we want to be part of your bank. You need to pay us. So it's a protection racket. And so it's criminals running a government, and he refuses. And so what happens to him is that his business is expropriated. $100+ million worth of assets are seized, and it becomes nationalized. It becomes the property of the thugs who run the Palestinian Authority. So this is one person who's coming to build something and who faces a regime that's there to exploit people, as opposed to leave them with the freedom and the rights to their property that are necessary conditions. And this is a well-recognized fact in any country, that without that necessary condition, you cannot thrive. Now, let's take a different example. So someone who's not a builder, someone who's not going to open a bank. How many people are going to open a bank, you might say? So one of the things that happens after 93 and 2005 is the Palestinian movement decides that its strategic goal is to increase the attacks on Israel. So in the 90s, we have an intifada, an uprising. And then since 2005, the Hamas takes over Gaza, and it uses that territory to launch rocket attacks, because that is part of its mission. Its founding document is to wipe Israel off the map. And not surprisingly, the Israelis say, well, we can't live like this. We can't have people from Gaza or the West Bank coming into work, because we don't know who you are. We don't know if you're wearing a suicide belt. So then you see the checkpoints proliferate. You see clampdowns. So for many years, people who used to come in to work in Israeli factories or Israeli restaurants and shops and so forth, they couldn't do it. And so the economy suffers as a result. And this is the argument I would make, and this takes some thinking about the history and so on, but this is a direct result of a movement whose goal is aggressive, and who, in retaliation, Israel puts up a wall because it realizes, well, we can't, a simple border crossing isn't enough. We need, and you can argue about the wisdom of the strategy as a defense step, but this is the genesis of Israel's so-called barrier or wall, which you've seen, many people have seen pictures of, because it looks ominous. It's this massive cement wall in many places, and it's barbed wire in other places. And then the lockdown and blockade of Gaza for many, many years, that's 15 plus years now. The blockade is a direct result of Hamas firing rockets and getting outside money and weapons, which it then uses to dig tunnels to infiltrate. So there is a direct result on the economic fortunes of people living in those places, because their ability to trade and build and just import and export their goods, think about the farmers, it's crushed. And you could, there's arguments to make about the way Israel's policy governs the input and output of people, but you can't drop the context and say, well, that's the primary. The primary is you're facing an aggressor. And what do you do in retaliation to that? How do you protect Israeli homes, Israeli businesses? How do you protect the lives and freedom of the people who's the responsibility of the Israeli government? And when you look at it from that perspective, what happens is it is not at all surprising the Gaza Strip and the West Bank are economically much worse off than they were decades ago. And they're just missed opportunities. I mean, a lot of people will say, this is a very common soundbite people have been throwing around, but it bears emphasis because it's true. In 93, when the world cheered the beginning of a peace process between Israel and the Palestinians, they saw the potential. Just an incredible, it was a very large community of people. And their neighbors in Israel really wanted to trade with them. And the way people thought about the Gaza Strip was, and particularly the West Bank too, these could be like Taiwan. These could be like what was in the 90s seen as these highly economically dynamic countries that are small but mighty. We saw some of them in the Far East. Nothing like that happened. And it's nothing like that happened because politically, the regimes that were created or imposed by force by the Palestinian movement are calculated to destroy people's freedom to do those sorts of things.
So I wanted to break in here with a sort of an observation and a question. You talked about leaving people free to do various things. Other governments didn't do that, but in fact, we're not free all on our own. We're not free in a state of no government or local warlords or local tribes or clans doing things. The kind of freedom it takes for people to start businesses, for people to do things on a grand scale, for people to become wealthy, for people to trade with people, for people to trade internationally with people, for people to just be secure in their lives and effects. That's not something that we have until some government or organization takes it away from us. That's something that has to be, that's a real achievement of civilization. There's no freedom without governments. Governments secure the rights but make us free. And when we're in a state of anarchy, of course, you couldn't be less free. And it's a question as to how could it be that there could be this movement? Because it sounds like a cartoon villain, like, you know, these PLO movements, and then they became Islamist and so forth. They're out to do something that destroys their own people and doesn't hurt them. How could it just sounds like, how can people be like that? How can a movement be like that? Surely there are put upon people who are in a bad way, and they gather together to try to protect themselves or better themselves. And where do we get off saying that, you know, blaming it on these people? And so I think understanding how that can be the case, how you can get an evil movement like this, if indeed it is an evil movement, you have to think about how difficult it is to get government right. And I think if we think back to the Zionist movement, and then think about the Palestinian movement by analogy to that, you see, you know, you can talk about individual people having grievances and so forth, but it's not just individual Jews in Europe had grievances, or individual people of Arab descent in Gaza or in Israel or wherever it would be had grievances. People thought we're being targeted or somehow things are bad for us because we are Jews. And because people see us as Jews and mistreat us as Jews, because we want to live as Jews in some cases, or some of us don't want to live as Jews. But, you know, some of this fact about us gives us a common defense interest. We're put upon, we're attacked, our rights aren't respected. We are, however they conceptualize it, we're victims, we're persecuted. And we face a common kind of persecution. So we need to band together against the people who would do us wrong and do us harm. And this is the story of human history. People come together to defend themselves against other people within and without who are harming them. And they need to do that, right? That's there are people who want to hurt you.
It's the default.
Yeah, and the
piece called Death is the Default. And I think, you know, political discord is the default.
It's a real difficult thing to figure out when you're in this situation. Even imagine a random group of people in anarchy and you don't know who's friend or foe and you're trying to come together to defense, or just a historical situation where there have been people descended from this guy and people descended from this guy living in the same rough geographic region for millennia, and there's mistrust and fighting between them, so they each band together. How to do that in a way that isn't just extended feuding, in a way that in your banding together with fellow Jews or fellow Palestinians or fellow whatevers for defense against whatever enemies you see, and for police actions and so forth, doesn't turn into people with protection rackets and so forth, as you described the PLO earlier. And notice that you see this all over the place in all kinds of cases. So if you watch, I don't know how historically accurate these are, but the Godfather movies, right? You have Italian Americans who are feeling persecuted and they get together to, like, you know, the police don't protect us and so forth. We've got to have our own thing that protects ourselves. And very quickly it's, you know, Murder Incorporated and a protection racket. You have, in general, people, it's the story of human history, or a major recurring story in human history. People feel the need to protect themselves. They group together to form a group that does it. That group is exploitative to them and dangerous to others, right? That's what a mafia is. That's what most governments have been. So if the PLO is like this, if Hamas is like this, that's no, like, aberration in history. That's how history tends to go. It's really difficult to get it right. And so if the Zionist movement got it semi-right in Israel, creating a kind of society that's not just
Just about
a protection racket or whatever for some group. That's a real achievement. If the American Revolution got it right, if the British various reforms at different times got it right, if the Civil War got it right, each of those things is something to be understood. How did something good happen here? How was built a political order that enabled people to survive and flourish? And not everybody. It might have been built with a lot of faults and problems. I mean, in America, the obvious example is slavery, which is, you know, you can't even call that a fault. It's so huge. It's a central problem with the country from the beginning. And yet you have a country in which people, many of them, were free to live and produce and create and explore and develop their human potentials in a way that people couldn't before, really anywhere, and that created an example and created a way of thinking that created tremendous internal pressures to resolve in a positive direction its major inconsistencies. And is Israel like that? Was the Zionist movement like that? Is that what's going on with the Palestinian movement or not? Or is this a kind of if it's not, it's not because there's something wrong. It's not some bizarre thing we need to explain. Most attempts to found a society and most movements around addressing grievance are self-destructive and are worse than, as bad or worse than the things they're trying to display. That's just the norm of human history. And
Greg, if I can kind of like relate this back to the context I'm familiar with, right, which is that individual level struggle. I've treated plenty of people in therapy who've had terrible traumas, who've been the victims of very real injustices, who have grievances. And I've seen, and I think psychology as a field has seen, the different ways that that can play out for a person and the ways in which a natural, even, you know, understandable default is that you end up caught in a kind of recurrent cycle of defense and attack, right? You end up kind of carrying over the same patterns of, you know, aggressiveness and hostility that to which you were subject, you now transmit those to your children, transmit those to your partners, right? You kind of just keep playing out that broken record. Whereas the thing that's really hard, the thing that isn't the default, the thing that has required a great deal of, you know, research and thinking and experimentation, is actually escaping that cycle and building a constructive and new, right, life with kind of with real positive aspirations, where you're not just caught up in your victim identity and your victim narrative.
Yeah. So one central thing is, I was stressing, there's a kind of politics is hard. Forming countries is hard. There's a kind of political wisdom that needs to be found, acquired, figured out to create a state that's not just a reaction back against previous situations, but can actually serve to help people live. And I'm very skeptical of liberation movements of any kind. I think hardly any of them have liberated anybody. And if all you know about somebody is that they're a liberation movement that's on about getting out from under the thumb of some other group, the odds are they're going to end up killing a lot of people, including the people in the group. I mean, that doesn't make me think well of a group. I want to know more about it before I know well of it. But then the second is, what is it? There's a lot of details about what kind of society, what kind of government, et cetera. But what is the kind of fundamental value that has to be central to one of these movements for it to be successful, even apart from the details of the kind of political structure, what kind of country is it trying to create? And I think here the issue is very analogous to in one's own life. Like, everybody has had suffered, you know, maybe trivially, but maybe profoundly, injustices. Everyone's been kind of put upon in some way or another. And it is a real legitimate value to get back at, destroy, protect oneself from, fight back against the injustice. The kind of slogans, no peace without justice and so forth, that you hear from liberation are often right. You don't want to just roll over and let people have their way with human beings. There's also
and on the flip side, there's a slogan that hurt people hurt people.
Yeah.
Right. Which is meant to normalize and to really kind of explain, perhaps to, in some cases, excuse, but certainly explain the tendency to get so fixated, so preoccupied with that defense goal, kind of with taking, you know, revenge, with getting that justice, that you forget the why and wherefore,
which is pose the question, and then one of, I think, the really kind of significant philosophical question here, both for individuals but then also for societies and movements to reform society, is what is the relationship between positive goals for life, what you're trying to develop, or what you're trying to make your life about, and defense against injustice? Like, suppose you've had injustices perpetrated against you. What does a healthy and moral version of I'm trying to pursue my life, including right these injustices and take them seriously, I'm not going to trivialize them and say, oh, they don't matter so long as I can find a way to earn a living or something, but I'm also not going to become like Captain Ahab or something, fixated on some vendetta and swallow up my life and everybody else's life to it. That's a hard thing to do. And what can we say about that in the context of the Israel-Palestine?
I'd like to respond to that, because I think one of the things we haven't talked about, and I want to just put it on the table, because I think it'll be helpful for thinking about the question you're raising, which I agree with. It's hard to build a country. It's actually Israel's bizarrely successful. Like, if you think about it, the same year Israel was founded, Pakistan was founded. Pakistan is not the kind of country you want to immigrate to. It's not the place where you think about high tech being a characteristic. It's very it's torn. It's a very broken country. So it's really an unusual accomplishment. I agree with that. And I think to the second part of your point, which is the one I want to dwell on, what is it that people do in reaction and sort of the sort of pattern you're describing? I think it's important to say a few things about the kinds of grievances that have arisen, the kinds of things that are seen as injustices, and then to think about how to sort them out. Because I haven't really said much about this, and this is a big part of what I talk about in the book. It's just not true that anytime someone feels aggrieved, they really have been dealt with unjustly. And that's just, it's hard to experience that and just feel like, well, maybe it's not true. I'm not really a victim here, or maybe this wasn't the right response. And the way I think of the grievances of Palestinians is it's a mixture of some individual level injustices. Some of them you could rectify, some of them you can't because of the passage of time. But but I bracket those because I think those, as bad as they were, they still do not warrant the kind of things we've seen as justified on the basis of them in sort of on the political scene. And then, so that's one kind of grievance that you can talk about. And I can say more about that. But the other kind, which I think is really, this goes to the sort of philosophical and psychological aspects you guys are interested in, is there's a way in which you can see a development and filter it through a kind of collectivized or tribal perspective and view it as a grievance, when what you should be doing, if you really valued progress and freedom in your own life and opportunities, you would view it very differently. So let me give you an example. So one of the things that got many of the this is back in the early 20s, 30s, 40s, when the political community leaders in the area that was under British rule, we call Palestine, as they were trying to accommodate and figure out, what do we think of these newcomers from Europe who are trying to build a Jewish homeland? What do we think of them? What are they doing? Some of the reactions were great. Here, let me sell you my land. Let me make a ton of money. And there was real a rejoicing at the huge amounts of money people were making selling land. These were often landlords who had tenants, and the tenants got really upset about this. And so there's real ways in which you have to think about, well, who's been treating me badly, my landlord or the guy who bought the land from him? And then there's sort of complicated situations that arise like that. One kind of reaction you could have is, wow, if I go and work in this factory, I can earn 10 times what I earned on the farm. And what you actually see is lots of people from the farms moving into the cities because that's where there was a lot more opportunity for economic, just to earn money and sort of grow and succeed. And and I think that's a healthy reaction. If you ask me, do you want to labor on a farm or do you want to earn 10 times more in a factory? I think it is really appealing to earn more in a factory, it's safer and so forth. That's one kind of reaction you can have to the fact that when the first settlers came, they built infrastructure, they built power plants, they built factories and shops and industry and real growth. And this is not the only growth there was. There was also growth on the Arab-Palestinian side. They were able to grow things and so forth as well. But the kind of reaction that I think is really problematic and is sort of psychologically unhealthy and morally, I think, is wrong, is to say the following, which they did say. How dare these foreigners come here? How dare they encroach on our historical land? And how dare they buy up the land that used to belong to my ancestors? They're just evil people and we have to fight them. Now, that is really bizarre. Because if you think about the opportunity being created, what would be a natural, healthier response is, okay, maybe I don't like them because they sound different or they look different or they behave differently from what I'm used to. But this is going to make this place so much better to live in. And in fact, it did. I mean, the standard of living that really rose, the kind of endemic diseases really went away because of medical facilities and just the proliferation of clinics and doctors and the availability of all those things. So when you filter it through a kind of tribal perspective and a perspective that resents progress as opposed to embracing it, that sees it as a threat, that sees it as, well, why don't I have to deal with this kind of thing? Why should I have to change my ways? Why are you coming in here and disrupting our traditional ways? When you have that kind of reaction, which I think is, there's a lot to say about that kind of reaction, and you foster it in other people and you convince them that that's a fundamental injustice to them, not because their land has been stolen from them. No, that hasn't happened. It's because their culture is being destroyed. And we hear a lot of that in today's immigration debate in the US. Like, how dare you have immigrants? They're going to destroy our culture. Well, that's essentially the kind of thing you heard from some of the Arab-Palestinian leaders. Is these people are bad for our culture. They're stealing our society. Well, my answer to that is, no collective owns land. No collective owns the country in which they are present. And it's mistaken thinking to view it as, if you legally acquire land, whether in Texas or Mandate Palestine, you went through you checked all the boxes legally, and you're the neighbor and you don't like it, that's not an injustice against you. It isn't. And if you process it that way, you become someone who is susceptible to the worst kind of demagogues and worse than demagogues. You become susceptible to the kind of authoritarian political movements that I've been describing. And to me, there's a real question about when you think about injustices and how people react to them, you really have to think hard about, what am I reacting to? Is this an actual injustice? If it is, what would it look like to solve it? If it isn't, why am I viewing it this way? And if what you're doing is bringing in a kind of tribal anti-effort, anti-progress mentality, that's condemnable to me. It's not a valid position to hold. Well, I don't want progress. And when people come here and they build a factory, I hate it. And that's an injustice against me. And my point is not that that was the uniform view. My point is that was a prevalent view. And it was a view that was encouraged and fostered. And it became the basis for a kind of grievance mentality that then gives rise to, well, then what we have to do is slaughter them. What we have to do is go sabotage them. What we have to go and do is put every roadblock possible in their way, because they're destroying our kind of cultural heritage, kind of collective identity perspective, as opposed to, well, we had rights, they weren't protected, let's figure out what to do about that, which is a different, very different kind of analysis. And in some cases, that was true. You might say this person's rights were violated. That wasn't the predominant phenomenon. The predominant phenomenon was people were pushed into a view of injustice that I think is not well-grounded. And there's more to say about the way in which those kinds of grievances have a psychological dimension, which I'm not qualified to talk about, but I can tell you one thing. If you tell three generations of people that the houses that they left during a war as refugees, if you tell them that those houses, which no longer exist, for whether because they were destroyed in the war or because somebody bought them, or somebody occupy them, even unjustly, if you tell them that they can go back when there's nothing to go back to, you're giving them an illusion. And that's really unhealthy. And you have to ask yourself, what is the moral status of a leader who tells his people, who sells them a fantasy of something that cannot be achieved? Because it cannot be achieved.
Yeah, I can't help but draw a parallel between a lot of what I hear you describing, Alon, and like the populist pro-Trump movement in America. I mean, so much of what you're describing, the kind of xenophobia, the, you know, defining oneself in terms of this aggrieved minority whose rights have been trampled, and that has to be the kind of defining feature of our politics and of our day-to-day kind of investment of resources. Like, let's tear down those wokes. Let's tear down, let's build our wall and protect ourselves against the enemy that's going to destroy our culture. Let's make America great again by returning to our tribal roots. Like, there's so much of it feels analogous, and the psychology feels analogous in terms of kind of where you get pulled. And I think we see it on both sides of that culture war, kind of where people get just like sucked into not just a victim narrative, but like a defensive, destructive narrative, where like being a victim and aggressing back becomes your motivational center, right? More so than like, who do you like, what kind of life do you want to be building? What do you want for you, for your children, for your family? Like, you know, what do you want to be about? What useful things do you want to do? What sort of joy do you want to experience in your life?
I want to go back. We can connect it to various factions in current politics. And my view is most factions in most politics at most times are like this. Right. And almost every faction, you can find elements of it. So if one party is better than the other at a given time, no doubt you'll still find some bit of the party that's functioning this way. That's kind of how politics tends to go. It's an achievement for it to go differently. But I want to flag a lot in the kind of what you're saying. The role, so two things. One, the role in which contentious questions of political philosophy are in the background of all of this. And then two, how can we think about that when we're not, we might not know the answers to some of those questions you're asking. Well, if someone complies within the law and they buy something and you've got nothing, no grievance against them, well, I mean, if, you know, the Nazis have expropriated all your property and then someone buys the painting from the Nazis, that's not well and good. The fact that it happened to be within the law of the society at the time, if it was the case that all of this property properly should have belonged to the people who were on the land and farming it, but there were these exploitative chieftains or whatever, and they then sold it to these Jews, and the Jews were coming in and they were taking advantage of that fact and so forth. You can come up with ways in which it could be that people would have grievances, either against the people who owned it before or against the Jews who came in and found it. And if it was the case, and this is what I think powers that act, so, I think is behind the scenes of a decent amount of the hard left hatred of Israel on this issue. If it's the case that private property in land is dubious to begin with, and that land does belong to groups of people collectively who have been there since time immemorial or in the past, or who are, you know, somehow tied to the soil, if some, you know, well-heeled landlords in the society sell it to some interlopers who come in out of the tribe, maybe the laws let them do that, but that's wrong. It really ought to be, you know, owned communally in some feudal state or whatever it's supposed to, people imagine it's supposed to happen to it, on its way to some kind of socialist or fascist or whatever kind of utopia that they envision. And there's something wrong with people coming in. And nobody thinks, right, that the property arrangements in the Ottoman Empire or even the British Mandate were like perfect. So the question is how do you think fundamentally? So you could always come up with something to criticize. Why did this guy have title to this in the first place? But do we understand that is primarily property is privately owned? It ought to be traded. We can argue about whether this guy properly held title and this law for sale under this thing was good or bad and how to rectify it. Or do we think that, in which case, yeah, basically, what are you going to do if you come into some place and you want land? You buy it from the person who has title to it, and you're doing your best. And if it turns out that he didn't have the right claim to it or whatever, it'll get adjudicated in the courts later. And then the story that you're telling about these settlers had the right to buy the thing, and if they didn't, we can adjust it after the fact. That seems the right story. If you're dubious of private property, if you think property and land is somehow communal or civilizational, it's some optional, you know, whatever, then you see this as the rich capitalist Europeans exploiting the indigenous culture, and so you won't buy that kind of story where the Jewish settlers are within their rights to do what they're doing, and the people resenting them are have a mistaken grievance. So then we can go back and argue about what's the right political philosophy, what is the nature of property, and you know, we can do that. I teach a course, political philosophy, we talk about things like that in property. But the other thing to think about is one way to check if your view about what's right and wrong politically, what if your view of what grievance you have is plausible, is like, what role is it playing in your life? What follows from it? And something that follows that you have to be at perennial war forever or trying to wipe a people out or drive them wholly out of land, and there's no way to resolve it or reconcile it, is going to mean that it is not going to be, there's a lot of reason to check your premises if you find yourself in that kind of situation, whether your premise is about the fundamental nature of land rights or your premise is about the history of the situation. And I think that's part of what's going on here.
I think that's a really helpful sort of wider angle perspective. And I agree with you that the philosophic questions they're really close to the surface throughout this issue. And that's one of the reasons I was interested in writing and researching about this, But I'm going to say something that maybe sounds contradictory, which is, and you're asking how do people think about this, and not everyone's going to spend time becoming an expert on this issue. And I think there's legitimate need for a division of labor, and there's people who specialize and so forth. But this might be the contradictory point, which is when people come into this, there has to be a kind of reality check. So there's a way in which Israel is being analyzed on this issue in a way that we don't really apply the same kind of considerations to other countries, which country is not born out of conflicts and conquest? The United States, I live in California, that was not one of the British colonies when they brought people over. And there's a way in which one has to think about some of that history and bracket it, because at a certain point, it's history. There's nothing to be done about it. And the question that one can think about first-handedly, and I think this is an important thing, like really from your own experience, is if either side got to fulfill their ambitions, their political, economic ambitions, what kind of society would it look like? So this to your question is like full realization of the Palestinian vision. And I'm not saying every Palestinian supports this, but the movement that speaks for them, or that claims to speak for them and speaks for many of them, which we know, what does its success look like? And what do its actions look like? And then on the other side, what does Israel's fulfillment look like? And I think Israel is basically, it's fulfilled. It's a state. You can evaluate it. It's in real time. And the contrast, I think, is what is important here. So in the book, I ask people to think, where would you rather live? And I give some examples of Israel versus its neighbors. And I think the point of that, and the same thing applies to Israel versus the West Bank, Israel versus the Gaza Strip. If your concern about life is building the best kind of life you want, and really building, whether you're in business, you're in academia, you're in whatever field you're in, if you want to build a life, and do you want to be free to do that? In the present tense consideration, if I parachuted you into one or the other of these societies, where would you rather be, knowing the kinds of conditions that we're familiar with as supportive of human flourishing? And to me, that's, you might not be historically right. You might not know all the history, and maybe the history is very hard. It's not like I've spent 10 years on this, and it's not like someone couldn't come along and give me 6 facts that, this guy in that village didn't get what he said was. Yes, that's always going to be true. But the present tense evaluation is the one that I think anyone can come to. And the more you connect it to the values in your life, and you, Gina, you were talking about Teva, the pharmaceutical company, you were talking about other companies. And this isn't a kind of tribal celebration of, the Jews did this or the Israelis did this. This is about values that really enrich our lives.
Yeah, and one of the points you make, and I think in that very chapter that really resonates with me, is that includes, like, if you want to disagree, if you want to criticize your own government, if you want to have really heated debates with, Zionists about why they're so wrong to like dismiss other ideology, like you're freest to do that in Israel, including like if you're Palestinian, if you're a woman, if you're, if you want to be free to practice your Muslim religion, like you're actually going to be freer to do all of that. And I think that's what a lot of people miss.
On the present tense evaluation point, there's another just concrete that's very telling to me about this, which is very telling to me. This has to do with the role of the grievances in how you act now. I mean, I think just as a moral thought experiment for people in general, let me see this broader than the Israel-Palestine thing, and then I want to ask Alan about applying it to this case. I think you can, here's something I often do with people or groups. I take all of their claimed premises and purported goals, all the ones that I could, that it's not like self-evident to me, aren't irrational. They feel like they're put upon in this way. They believe this thing to be true. They think these people, and I can't tell for sure which ones are true or not, or which ones you could hold rational. So I just assume them all. And I imagine myself, if I were in that situation, how would I act? How would I act? How do I think someone should act if they believe a lot of their people have been displaced unjustly, if they The people are very poor, the situation, whatever the situation is, and take all the facts about the situation and all their purported values, again, that are not, I think, manifestly irrational. And then what would I do? What would I prioritize? And you could do it for people. You could suppose you think an election's been stolen from you. Suppose you think whatever. And all the facts say, what would you do? What would be a rational course of action? And what strikes me is that when I apply that to Hamas and to the Gazans who elected them, particularly when I think of what happened after the end of the Israeli occupation, you could say it's still occupied in a way, but the end of the, you know, the military rule, occupation rule in there. That's what's really striking and black and white to me. There's a real moral perversion governing the society that makes it dangerous to itself and to its neighbors. And so I just want to talk about that, like what happened and what should have happened if even assume there were lots of injustices against the Gazans at the end of the Israeli military rule. So Ilan, could you tell us a bit about that episode?
So the withdrawal, Israel withdrew unilaterally. So this was not a land for peace agreement, unlike many other agreements. This was just take the land, go figure it out. You do what you think you want to build here. This happened in 2005. And there were many people in through the international community who said, well, okay, this is a brave gesture. We'll pledge money to help Gaza build a society. And when the Israelis withdrew, they literally withdrew everyone, soldiers and civilians who were living there. And among the things that were left behind were farms and farm equipment and greenhouses. This is a famous episode with the greenhouses where, in effect, it's imagine if you just left a factory that was fully functional or a farm that was fully functional. You just walked away and somebody who then takes possession of it has a turnkey solution. Just go work the farm, build, you know, take advantage of it, and it's yours. There's no question of theft. It's just, it's abandoned property. Do the best you can with it. And instead of what you would hope that people would do, which is, okay, well, let's figure out how to make the best use of what we've been left behind here. The greenhouses were dismantled and used, smashed, and the farms were not put to use. So there was a rejection of that opportunity. And that isn't the whole story, because what happens then is Gaza becomes a self-administered territory, in effect, like a quasi-state. And it doesn't take long for Hamas to arm itself in a significant way and to start firing rockets from this territory, which did not happen previously, because previously they were under Israeli military rule. So that's the opportunity to build and grow and flourish trashed. The goal of wiping Israel off the map, that becomes a high priority. And at the same time, this is to speak to the character of Hamas as a movement, which you mentioned this, but it bears emphasis, Greg, that when there was an election, the only one since then, in the Gaza Strip, Hamas was allowed to run and it won that election by a landslide. And that was the precipitating cause for it coming to rule the whole territory. So there's a real strong signal at that time, at least, that they were popular. And it wasn't a protest vote. It was a significant embrace of Hamas. And what happens is that the people of Hamas are then subjected to what Hamas was long wanting to do, which is bring in more and more Sharia law or Islamic religious law. So whereas the Palestinians in that area were not particularly religious and they weren't required to observe all sort of the veiling and all sort of the gender separation between men and women, that all came in and it started feeling like, well, this has echoes of Afghanistan, and why can't women ride motorcycles, and why can't they cut the hair of men, why can't men cut women's hair? And then it becomes Islamicized in that sense. So with respect to Israel, it becomes hostile. With respect to its own people, it becomes theocratic. And the idea that you would build something there, that all goes in smoke, because what the real focus of the aid that flows into Gaza and the international aid, the UN aid, all of that, it gets repurposed, predictably, gets repurposed to Hamas's military mission, which is they build tunnels at a huge expense. I mean, people put price tags on these tunnels that go under the border and into Israel. They've built 30 odd of these over the years. Each of these tunnels is something like the equivalent of 5 or 6 homes or a modest sized hospital. Now, that is a significant problem. If what you're doing is, it's like a North Korea strategy. You put all your money into the military and you crush your own people. You enslave them in effect. Now, it's perverse because a lot of them embrace Hamas. A lot of them willingly fight for Hamas. I don't view them all as having the same view. And I think there are definitely, there's reason to think there are people who do not want to live under Hamas, and they, given the opportunity, they would leave. And some of them have left. But that's what we saw when Israel withdrew unilaterally. It became a much more hostile place that is at war with its own people and at war with Israel across the border to the extent that it can reach them.
And for any particular thing, like, well, this greenhouse was smashed or this factory wasn't used or whatever, you could say, well, there's resentment. They want to build or make something else or whatever. But the when you look at it macroscopically, not as a couple of episodes or issues or this place or that place, it seems like you see a society that's organized and mobilized around a grievance and around a perceived injustice and around fighting back against it and not around everything else, that all of life is being sacrificed. Every opportunity to growth, production, et cetera, is being sacrificed to getting back at Israel, which even if Israel had done something awful to it, that is not a way to live. And imagine if after the Holocaust, Jewish effort was in getting back at Germany, not at, building a state, building a life, building something, and trying to get just, like, there were those groups of people that went and hunted Nazis and brought them back for trials and so forth. And that was all well and good. And I think it was good and right and just within the context of a people trying to do a lot else and get justice for something. But if that became the whole purpose, you'd have to, even if the original cause was just, it would no longer be just. And the kind of maniacal focus on that, I think, should lead you to wonder if the original cause even is just, because that's not what prosecuting justice looks like. Gina, you had a topic you wanted to close.
Yeah. So in light of all that, if we circle back to, like, what do we, the rest of us living in the West, going about our lives and reading these news and seeing these horrific videos and reports on X or Twitter, or wherever, like, how do we relate to what's happening? How do we think about it? What do we want to watch within ourselves if we want to really kind of support the cause of builders worldwide? And one reason I really felt moved to kind of have this conversation is that I saw kind of two very common reactions on Twitter, in all the various places where people are commenting. One, which is really horrifying, and a lot of people have now, kind of distanced themselves from the kind of Harvard students, manifesto style retorts of this is all Israel's fault and serves them right. And what did you think that decolonization looked like? This is justice, being served. Where there's this question, like, do they know what they're actually referring to? Never mind all the political nuance that you've just shared with us, Alon, but knowing nothing else other than you're talking about the, gratuitous murder of babies, the raping of women, you're talking about savage mass killings, and you're spouting abstract concepts that you don't understand and I don't understand and probably no one in this discourse understands, but like comfortably. Right. And then on the other side, I saw a lot of, well, what do I know? I have nothing to say about this. Right. And I sort of heard myself echoing some of those sentences because it's really hard to know what to say and how it's going to get taken. But I feel like a big part of what emerges for me out of all this is, like, there's got to be a center for you. If we're talking about human life, like, we're talking about, like, how seriously are you taking this question? And that includes how to relate to all the things you don't know that are complicated, because what you do know, what you can see, is the gratuitous slaughter of human beings, and then everything else is like virtue signaling, everything else is talk. And if you find yourself taking comfort in abstract, complicated political slogans that you've borrowed from your group, and turning away from the really like in your face phenomenon, right, of like human life obliterated, right, like really kind of needing to check in with ourselves, right, and needing to check our own fundamental drivers and motivations, because all of these different motives can play out in us, right, as individual human beings.
Yeah, I let me offer a couple of thoughts on that. I agree. One of the things over and above the actual invasion and attack that was just horrifying, it's hard to process all of that. Over and above that, the thing that has really disturbed me more than I expected has been the reaction both in European cities and in North America, and especially on campuses, where a lot of people are, or at least vocal minorities, I'm not sure the numbers here, but enough that you see this, giving this a totally different gloss that doesn't integrate with what we're witnessing. And the question you have to ask is, what cause could justify this kind of behavior? And we can go backwards a step. What do you actually think is happening here? There's a real reason to pause and ask yourself, what do I believe and what's the basis for it? And does killing children in this way, and is going after civilians in this way, what do you think of that? So there's a real reason to pause there. But the other thing I wanted to say in connection with this, which I think is hopefully helpful to people, which is there's a way in which a lot of the discussion of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict is couched in what I loosely call the underdog premise.
Yeah.
And it's sort of like this default position that, well, they're the underdog, so there's sort of a default sympathy for them. And it's a bit harder with Hamas after this, you know, the October 7th invasion and all the atrocities that we're hearing about. But the wider phenomenon of the Palestinian movement, I don't speak for the Palestinian movement. They're this one group. And what is this underdog premise? And why is it significant? Because I think it's quite illuminating of what you're describing. It tells you that you don't need to know whether someone's in the right or not. You just need to know if they're suffering, if they're weak. And the more suffering, the more obviously weak, the more there's an imbalance of power in the conflict, the more you should side with the parties that seem weaker, more oppressed, or say they are more oppressed. And real questions of justice are not solved that way. Real questions of justice are not about siding with whoever has the least power or the least opportunity. Questions of justice have to do with, what are your goals? What are your means? What are you trying to accomplish? And what have you done to people? And was it right to do that? And this is what people have trouble with. And I think this goes to the kinds of reactions you're describing.
Yeah.
It's hard for people to process that you can be very powerful and a victim, and you can be very weak and an aggressor and in the wrong. And this has been part of the story of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And you have to see it in those terms, because if you buy into this premise that the weaker is the one that by default deserves your sympathy or your support, then Israel can do no right because it's succeeded. And the Palestinians can do no wrong because they're going to just be weaker materially, and they're weaker militarily. And let me just tie this to what you're saying, because I'm having trouble articulating the point. It gives the weaker aggressor a blank check, in effect. And that's part of the disgusting aspect of this, which I think is, let me just give you one concrete under this. So Hamas routinely inflates the number of casualties. This is known in past rounds of attacks. Hamas issues a number of casualties from its health ministry. I don't know if that's true. Do you know if it's true? Does anyone know if it's true? I don't know. So it's something you have to put an asterisk on, just like any communique. But it's taken at face value. Israel tells people, look, we had hundreds of people at this concert. We had people in these villages who were slaughtered. Babies were slaughtered. Some of them decapitated. Hold on a second. We need a proof. Like, why can't take that at face value? Well, why can't you take it at face value if you take Hamas at face value? And I think part of what's going on here is that, well, are we going to trust you? You're the stronger party. You've got an interest in deceiving us. Whereas Hamas, well, you know, there's problems with Hamas. They're not really showing the best side today, but what do you think? And that really perverts people's ability to think about these issues. And that's not maybe the strongest example, but it's the idea that you can go around chanting Free Palestine on college campuses and through the city that I grew up in, London, and see these tens and tens of people, thousands of people. And to think that what Hamas is doing is really geared towards freedom, you have to be lying to yourself. And the people who are narrating this or giving us a commentary on it in the pages of the New York Times and pages of the Washington Post and other publications are treating this in such a way that it's Israel is by default guilty until proven innocent. And Hamas is, well, how could we hold it? They broke out of the prison. And this is what to expect from resistance fighters. And that is not at all the right way to think about this. And my claim, which I think takes more work to justify, but I want to indicate for people to think about, is so long as your moral framework tells you to side with the weaker party by default and against the stronger party without knowing why they're strong or why they're weak and who's actually committed crimes and who hasn't, so long as that's your orientation, you're going to have the wrong way of processing this information. You're going to end up with bad conclusions. You can end up enabling bad people doing harm to good people.
Yeah. So, and at an individual level, where this comes up for builders, where this comes up, and why I care so much about exposing my audience to this perspective, is that we also see the same morality of a kind of victimhood and weakness in the kind of thinking that cripples, for example, entrepreneurs from advocating for the needs of their company against the one kind of manipulative employee who disrupts the operations of the company while proclaiming themselves a victim of this or that, you know, policy, and defending and promoting the value of the product or the service that they provide against the onslaught of, you know, media attacks and cultural attacks on just the fact that this company even exists. You know, think Meta, right? Think Google, think Microsoft. And as a startup founder, I've seen, you know, time and again, this kind of sheepishness, this kind of, you know, like self-destructive tendency in the face of what one sees as one's own guilt for doing well, for providing value, for amounting to something. So this is not just a, you know, a geopolitical phenomenon. It's very much a personal one that I see day to day, and you know, and I hope that we can draw lessons from both.
And it's not just a moral mistake, but it's a moral inversion in general.
Yeah.
It's not just that if you think the weaker party is the one in the right, you'll sometimes get it wrong because sometimes they'll be the one in the wrong. You'll usually get it wrong. Ability, strength, wealth come from good things about us. They're all accomplishments. They're all achievements. They have to be built. They have to be made. There are plenty of cases, of course, in which people aren't equal to their good trait. So they build up something good and they misuse it. There are cases in which the stronger party is the worst. But if all you know about people is that one is capable, one is able, one is powerful, that's a good thing about them. And there are a lot of people who are going to resent them for it, or just won't, you know, won't care one way or the other. So it's not the case.
View them as tall poppies to be cut down. Which
that
I see
in
again,
general,
again,
the powerful, the strong, the successful, the able, the rich are bad, and the or should have any kind of suspicion of them. Think about these are people who just broke out of a prison. Yeah, people who just broke out of a prison are usually pretty bad people, right? Now, sometimes they're not. Sometimes they've been unjustly imprisoned. But the society in general is strong enough to imprison many of the worst people within it. Not always, sometimes unjustly. But it's the default is, you know, should not be with the weak, the imprisoned, etc. To think that it should be is to think that human ability comes from vice, or at least doesn't come from virtue ever.
Right. It's just innate and automatic. And some people are just lucky enough to be privileged, right, and to be bestowed all this wealth and power, and some aren't. And there's a motivation behind that kind of worldview, because it's much easier. It's an easy morality. You don't have to earn it. In fact, on the contrary, the worse off you are, the less you've done, the less you've made, the less you've amounted to, the more claim you have to virtue, and vice versa, right? People who have built something, people who've exercised their agency, builders, to the extent that they are builders, are a threat to that kind of easy virtue.
I just wanted to add one more thought to this. So I appreciate your comments. I think you put it really well, Greg, that it's not that you're going to sometimes get it wrong. You're usually going to get it wrong, because the fundamental is achievement and creation and building and the choice to do all those things. One observation I will offer is, independent of this political foreign policy space, which I've noticed broadly, and I think it's applicable there too, but I'm curious if you've seen this as well. The more someone is on the orientation of building and choosing to create value and really having a sort of ambitious view of life and embracing that and challenge and so forth, it's common for someone in that position to take their own approach as a given, which is just, that's all we ever have access to, is our own sort of experiences, right? We take that as a, it's not unusual to take that as a given. And it's very difficult not to assume that that's true of other people. Mm-hmm. And the result is, it's hard to get into the mindset of, well, how could someone really not be on this premise? How could it be true that what they're actually trying to do is cut me down or really undermine me? And that there's a real negative orientation, and sometimes really evil, not just negative. And I think that there's some of that happening on a global scale in this conflict and in other conflicts where, I mean, the exact, this is going to maybe not resonate with people who are too young, but one of the things that I keep going back to is when George W. Bush was in power in the US, he had this, what I call a democracy crusade. And the premise of this crusade was, everyone's basically like Americans. Everyone wants to have freedom. Everyone wants a better life. And if we bring elections to the Middle East, that's what will happen. People will vote in better people to govern them, and they'll be flourishing, and this will be a watershed moment for freedom. I don't think Bush's problem was fundamentally that he was projecting his own sort of orientation, or that he's sort of this, but there is this sort of default that is common to better people, that they can't see. That's not true. It's not true that everyone wants freedom. It's not true that everyone wants to build. In fact, there are people who want to destroy. And that's the face of evil that's hard to reckon with. And whether it's an interpersonal conflict or it's a political situation, I'm curious if you've seen that, because I definitely think it's one of the ways in which better people, unless they're more worldly or unless they've had enough exposure to this, it's hard for them to recognize it and to really get outside of their own context on this.
Yeah, I think that's right. But I think, and Greg, I mean, I've probably learned some of this from you, so I'll let you have the last word. But part of the way to make it real, and I've struggled with this as a therapist, as someone who wants to believe in the, you know, best in everyone, and my whole job is to bring out the best in everyone. So I want, you know, I'm extremely motivated to it. And I get a kind of non-representative sample of people who have brought themselves to therapy or coaching. So chances are, you know, more often than not, they're on a premise of wanting to grow, to improve, of holding themselves accountable. And yet, it's moments like these, you know, when this kind of horror comes before my eyes, that I really have to remember that there's evil. And one way that one way I make it real to myself is, noticing those motivations cropping up sometimes in small ways in myself. Because I think we all have the capacity for evil as well as good. And it never starts with, mass murder, right? Anytime that we've kind of rationalized away for ourselves, like a kind of moment of ill will towards someone because they had gotten the award and we didn't, or because they're already so far ahead of us, and like we were just a little bit withholding of the kind of genuine, celebratory enthusiasm that we might have been their due in a conversation because we're just a little bit annoyed that they've reminded us of what we lack, right? Like it's just tiny, but those tiny moments of what I see as vice, what I see as kind of putting ourselves on a kind of premise of trying to evade away the possibility of building rather than really trying to build. Like each of us has done it. Each of us is capable of it. And if we can understand and really be honest with ourselves about those motivations in ourselves, then I think it becomes still, hard, but kind of brings within our cognitive grasp. Yeah, like that can metastasize. That can become the driving, organizing principle of someone's life and of a culture, right? And of a movement.
Yeah. So to talk about it metastasizing, I had a talk I gave a few years ago on the nature of evil, and I very much used that metaphor about certain kinds of destructive motivations, adversive motivations, attack type motivations, which can be valid and a proper part of a life within a certain context, subordinated to other goals, governed by them, can come to rule you if you don't keep them in their context. And I talked a lot about what evil looks like, how it's like a kind of cancer, a part of something growing out of proportion and taking over the rest. But I want to stress in talking about it here, the cultural side of it rather than the individual side. Because it is true about an individual, but like if you talk about George Bush and the Ford Strategy for Freedom, I don't think what was going on there was George Bush was this really admirable guy with his really admirable psychology who couldn't recognize that some other people had very different psychologies from him. Although I think, the psychology of bin Laden is surely worse than Bush's, but deeply so. But I think it's more that Bush took for granted a kind of cultural values of America that even, not very great people have in America and have in Western Europe. And imagined that all cultures were like that. Imagined that everybody was like that and wasn't recognizing the kind of hard-won positive features of our own culture and way of life that are kind of inculcated in people and that were not inculcated in everyone at every time. Indeed, they're very rare in human history. And I think part of what you have to do to think about that and to understand that is the same kind of thing that Gina was thinking about in yourself. Notice in your own culture, in American culture, in European culture, in Israeli culture, there are all kinds of movements, indeed, maybe more of the movements that are tearing down that destructive to, acidic to, poisonous to what's good about the culture than what's bad about it. Then there are that are promoting what's good about it. Even among people who grasp that the rule of law matters and so forth, there are elements in every political party and every that are destructive to that are tribal, that are let's get ours and to hell with the other people, and our getting ours doesn't relate to or involve or require the society being more just, being better formed. It's just a kind of, fighty kind of reflex. That's there all the time. It's there in every culture. And it's something that the better cultures have learned to contain, have learned to have something that's more fundamental of value to them than, have learned to
some degree
to get rid of that and have never learned it completely and perfectly, which is why there's so much injustice in so many cultures. And one has to be really aware of that. And it's hard to keep it in view. And then the other thing that I think it's just worth saying as part of this, and that's important to see that in your own culture, in your own institutions, in your culture, because it's not just how are all of the individual people, but like, what are the norms within this government body? And what are the, how do people get into these position? How do people get counted as elites in your society? And then what is the kind of culture among the elites as well as among the more common people? And there's always some injustice there, but there's also some good things about institutions and credentialing mechanisms that cause certain kinds of ideas to come to the fore rather than how is all that functioning in your culture? And it's something to sort of be aware of, to think about, to worry about. And one of the reasons why we're so loath to think ill of other cultures is from one of these good traits, but I think that sometimes taken out of context. We're very aware of the possibility of being tribal, being racist, being imperialistic, thinking we're the Americans, we're the Europeans, we're the whatever. Those other people are savages. They don't have any good. There's something genetic or deeply built in. They're different from us. And that's the only alternative to thinking if only given the opportunity, they'll have a free and prosperous society. So therefore, if you see that as the only alternative, either they're, you know, monsters, there's some other species, or they're just like us. And you know it's evil to treat other people and think of them as like a non-human species that you can just dominate and enslave and so forth, then you're going to gravitate towards, well, they've got to be just like us. And the fact is that people are innately essentially alike. Culture is what matters. Culture is what makes groups of people different from one another. Cultures are ideas and ways of thinking. And ideas and ways of thinking are slow and hard to change. Individuals can change their ways of thinking relatively quickly compared to a whole culture. But if you're thinking
still
about
it's really hard.
But still it's hard. That's what psychology is about, and that's what personal growth is about. But if you're thinking about we're going to not take the self-selecting group of people who want to immigrate to somewhere else because they value the culture in that other place, but we're going to like try to change how a whole country is functioning or expect it to change overnight, it can change, but it takes time and it has to be realistic about it and not assume for better or worse that they share the features of your culture or some other culture you're on about.
I mean, and this whole perspective, it like starts from this understanding that like it's an achievement to build a positive culture, to build a like a humanistic pro freedom and flourishing culture. And I think that perspective, you know, you have to build it, right? The default is that we're at each other's throats and that competing tribes focus on who's going to out destroy whom rather than what we're going to build. Right. And if we've like were to recognize that, then this kind of flinching default judgment that you see of, okay, well, the Israel is the aggressor. And if only if only Israel would just lay off punishing us with these restrictions and putting up these walls and borders, like then we would flourish and be free. As if that's how it works, and as if that's the, you know, it's because of these bad things that Israel has done.
I don't think that's what Hamas thinks. If only Israel would do this, then we'd flourish and be free. I don't think they want to.
I think it's. I think the better Americans who are sympathetic. Yeah, that's what I mean. That's who I'm addressing here. Yeah, the better Americans, Westerners who are sympathetic to the Palestinian cause, who think, you know, well, if they're suffering, if they're not, you know, flourishing, if they're not building, if they're poor, if they're downtrodden, it must be because someone is aggressing against them. So we must remove that, you know, crime of commission so that then they can just flourish, forgetting that like flourishing is not the default. Flourishing is really hard. And it takes building a culture and an infrastructure and, you know, and a government that's not oriented around destruction, but around
We're at the end of our time. So this raises a huge issue that we haven't had time to address. I just want to name it because people will be thinking of it. And I want to tie it then back to what we were talking about. So, okay. So what do you then do if you have on your border a group of people who are very culturally different from you? You can't just, let them hold an election and they elect a bunch of people who want to rain missiles down on you and destroy everything there. But you also can't govern them like, and don't want to and shouldn't want to govern them like an apartheid state, and which is what people claim Israel has been doing there. I don't think that's a fair criticism, a fair claim, but it is a, you know, there is an issue. There are these other people who aren't Israelis, yet they're under Israeli jurisdiction and they're not treated the same. And how do you manage that? What is the right way to handle that? It's a difficult question. It's a hard thing. Yeah. It's one reason why you shouldn't want to invade your neighbors if you don't have to.
Yeah.
So you might have to because you need it for your safety. But what should America have done to Japan? What should America have done to Germany after it invaded them? How should a country that's occupying another country and doesn't think they're think they need to be pacified for their own safety? How should you deal with them, given all these facts we said about countries? That's a hard question. I have some views as the answer. We haven't really said anything about the answer here, but don't need to know the answer to that question to know that people from a semi-occupied territory who have no agenda for how they're going to make a free, prosperous, and safe country in that territory, if only they had more control over it than they already have, who have not been doing anything to increase the prosperity, happiness, and opportunities for the people in it, that a group of people doing that are not on the right, are not trying to rectify this problem of how do you deal with your neighbors, are not on the side of virtue when they paraglide in to their neighbor's country and lop the heads off of babies. You don't need to know the answer to the difficult political question about how to treat neighbors to know that this is not what a legitimate resistance movement looks like. And to know that it deserves to be condemned.
For the sake of those who want to live.
Yeah.
Everywhere.
Just have one thought I'd like to leave with. And this doesn't have to be the last word if you guys want to add, but I just wanted to say one thing, which is to amplify some of the points that have come up in the last 15, 20 minutes or so about disentangling this issue from race and tribe and really emphasizing the issue of culture and ideas. So I appreciated your clarification about Bush. I think it is true. The wider phenomenon is that people who grow up in free societies just assume that other people have the same kind of cultural orientations and assumptions, and they're just not true. And it's important to recognize that and to recognize that that difference is not innate. That difference is a consequence of many, many choices, all of which can be undone. But as you said, it's hard and it's difficult. It's individually difficult, and it's difficult even more so at a cultural level. And I think it's important to stress that, because this conflict in particular lends itself or easily is reframed as racial or tribal, or by default, it's seen in collective terms. And the collective terms is Jews versus Arabs. And no one can quite tell you what an Arab is, because it's as difficult a concept as Jew to pin down. It's both cultural, it's quasi-religious, it's very complicated. So I want to stress that this is, as I see it, and this is the way I approach it in my book, it's a conflict rooted in ideas which develop and express themselves in cultural patterns and behaviors. And so both politically and then culturally, and those things are what you can evaluate and you should evaluate and praise or blame. And the individuals who hold those ideas and choose to hold those ideas or fail to choose to question them. And I think that's the essential issue here, which is these are ultimately matters that are subject to human choice and volition. They're not innate. They're not unchosen or incidental to who we are. They're how we make ourselves. And to your theme of building, I think another sort of fundamental way to think of this issue is we each build ourselves, whether we do it consciously or not. Right. And how we do that at a macro level is what our society looks like, and that sort of the institutions and the culture. And in that sense, the culture is also something we build, but we build it indirectly. And it's important to see that that's a human made thing. It's not something that is somehow biological.
It's not the default, and it's not free.
And it could be different. And it could be better. And if you ask me if you rewound the clock and said in 1993, when there was a peace agreement, or in 2005, what would you have wanted the Palestinian society to look like 20 years hence? this is not what I would have wanted. I don't think anyone reasonable would have wanted this. And what would have been better is if it looked a lot more like Israel, if it looked a lot freer, where there was greater opportunity for people to build. And that's something that was a choice in significant degree. And it could be a choice going forward for people down the road. It's going to take a long time to get there. But I think that sort of differentiation between the chosen versus the unchosen, the built versus the born, I think those are really important for thinking about this issue.
Let's close with some recommendations. One, obviously, is Alon's book, which is What Justice Demands. I forget the subtitle.
America and the Israeli-Palestinian Conflict.
America and the Israeli-Palestinian Conflict. On this last topic of occupied peoples or people after an occupation and how to get out of that and how to move to a different kind of society, I'd like to recommend a book from a deceased friend of mine, of ours, John David Lewis, has a book called Nothing Less Than Victory, where he talks about ongoing conflicts that were eventually decisively ended and how that led to cultural change in the conquered peoples. I'll recommend then two pieces by one by me and one by Gina. I mentioned my talk on the nature of evil earlier, which is up on YouTube. So if you just Google my name and the nature of evil, you'll find that talk. And Gina has a talk, a piece rather, on her Substack, I think it is, entitled Death is the Default. And if people, Gina, if they just Google you in that title, will they find it? Mm-hmm. All right. So those are some recommendations from us on some of our work on this topic. I hope you guys have found this interesting, and I'm not sure when we'll be back on this channel, but we have some events coming up from the Objectivism Program in the next few weeks. If you follow the Salem Center's events page, you'll see our events as well as some others. Thank you, Alon, for joining us, and thank you, Gina.
Thank you both.
Thanks for having me.
Glad we did this. Thanks. All the best.